everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of Discourse, the Saints bi-weekly international affairs and discussions podcast. In many ways, this month has been all about pushing women to the forefront. Officially, March is Women's History Month, which this year has coincided with both International Women's Day and Mother's Day in the UK. This should be a cause for celebration, so it's more than a bit ironic that March has also seen us mark the 3-year anniversary of Sarah Everard's murder and uncover the alleged sexual misconduct of Red Bull bigwig Christian Horner. So, here to discuss some pretty pressing women's issues internationally and delve into our worryingly precarious welfare structures at home, I'm joined this week by Shakila Bessel and Nora Mahmoud. Lovely to have you both. Shakila is a fourth-year international relations student, and it's really great to have you with us. I'm hoping that you might be willing to kick things off with a bit of light controversy for us.
Hi, my controversial opinion is social media platforms such as Instagram, TikTok and YouTube should automatically make any content featuring or centred around children ineligible for monetization, including any paid sponsorships.
Well, we could pretty much do a whole podcast on that alone. But instead, I'm going to move on to Nora, who's in her third year here at St Andrews studying modern history and IR. She also works with the UN Association St Andrews and New Global Normal, and as a Laidlaw scholar has completed a research project on the children of transatlantic slavery. A pretty impressive CV, but I'm hoping you also have a bit of low culture scoop for us this morning.
Well, I think my controversial opinion would be that despite the CV, I really love to hate LinkedIn, hate to love LinkedIn, but that's all I have really.
Nice. Well, I'm impressed that you're on LinkedIn as a third year. So on that day, I think it's time we get onto some of the more serious stuff. Shakila, I was hoping you could start us off, as I know you were keen to discuss some ideas around International Women's Day and Mother's Day generally.
I thought it would be quite nice to acknowledge that both International Women's Day and Mother's Day has just passed, especially because I feel like our opinions have probably changed as we've gotten older and become more experienced with the world. And although I think it's pretty important to acknowledge women and the days that surround us, I think we should also take into consideration that the commercialization of these days becomes quite harmful.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think we've all read an article in the Times this week that was saying that we should effectively ban International Women's Day and Mother's Day on that basis. I think, yeah, what's really come to light as I've been reading around this is that we definitely still need to be celebrating International Women's Day. I know that their official sort of focus this year was inspiring inclusion, which was trying to look at technology and the way that that can obviously really harm and discriminate against women, but it can also really be used favorably. And if we get on board with these schemes early, then obviously that will like wreak greater benefits moving forward. So I think it's really important that we have these days, but it's also really concerning how easily they're managed to be turned into just a kind of corporate band slogan. Do you have any thoughts, Nora?
Yeah, well, I think especially the controversy around International Women's Day and commercialization, this like we see this happening a lot with kind of more like radical social movements. Like we see this happening with Pride as well, and like rainbow washing, and how Pride events, which were previously seen as like a form of protest, are kind of made into this commercial money grab almost. I mean, there's definitely was like International Women's Day, like cards and gifts and like that kind of stuff was encouraged. But I feel like dismissing it wholesale is not necessarily the solution. I think like recognizing the commercial aspects and how that's harmful is the most important thing to like, so that we can actually have the conversations about what needs to be done. Because obviously there's more work that needs to be done, and just like abolishing International Women's Day isn't going to really help with that. Like it can kind of detract from the message, and that's why we need to be careful with it. But I feel like there needs to be kind of a two-hand solution to doing it.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that if you look at the origins of International Women's Day, it began as a very political, like demonstrative, like basically just mass demonstrations across the world that were all organized on the same day. And it sort of has managed to be depoliticized and turned into this corporate branding tool where, you know, one woman gives a cursory speech to a room full of other women about women in business. And ironically, you know, it would almost distract women from performing their like high caliber roles in a way, rather than like contributing to the global movement for women. I think it's also really important to just recognize like how lucky we are in the UK compared to internationally. And maybe I would ask both of you whether you think International Women's Day sort of generalizes the experience of women too much, and whether we can identify an international woman figure, or whether that sort of differs too much to really bear any characterization.
Yeah, I think the part I struggle with, like, I love International Women's Day and I love Mother's Day. I think it's such a powerful day. But I think I sometimes ask myself, like, but for who? Like, we are so lucky that we live in, like, a Western world and, like, we have access to technology and we know that this is an important day. But I think it's so important to acknowledge that there isn't one universal experience of being a woman, and there are, like, multiple hardships, and it's a very intersectional experience. I know for me, like, I grew up on a council estate with a single mother, and my experience of Mother's Day and International Women's Day is probably a lot different to what most people's are. So I think it's an amazing day when we use it as an act of remembrance and an act of resistance, but it can be harmful when we think of it as like one objective experience, because that's not what it is to be a woman.
Mm. I guess it almost risks complacency in a way, because if you look at UK figures, I mean, the experience of women has improved in many aspects over the last 100 years since International Women's Day began. In 1979, women made up just 3% of MPs. Today, they represent 34%. You know, a lot of women are now employed. And I think that, you know, narratives around women are definitely changing in the UK, but compare that to internationally, where actually a lot of women are going backwards in their experiences. And it's just, yeah, it doesn't really bear any comparison, maybe.
Yeah, I think, like, in some regard, we definitely need that intersectionality to kind of see beyond, like, this Western privileged perspective we're coming from. Not to say that any experience in the West is, like, ideal and that we should ignore International Women's Day, but it is going to have different resonances and different meanings depending on where you're from. Being a woman in a place where you don't have access to education, you don't have access to basic reproductive rights, hygiene, other things like that, is going to be such a different experience. And being a mother in those places is such a different experience than being a mother in the UK or the United States. So I feel like that's where the work needs to be done in International Women's Day, and we can't forget that part of it. And I think that the fact that International Women's Day is, like, officially recognized by the United Nations, while the Times article critiqued that fact, I think it does kind of give more space for those parts of it to be recognized, and recognize that it's a spectrum of the ways women are being impacted. And that has to be remembered so that it doesn't kind of fall into that complacency of white Western feminism that kind of is out of touch with other parts of the world and what is essentially really important steps that need to be taken immediately.
And I think another angle that I'd like to this from is just sort of, I don't know, the corporate and hypocritical interpretations of International Women's Day. One that really hit home for me was the fact that Alicia Keys is going to be performing at a Formula One Saudi Arabia International Women's Day celebration. So in the same country that imprisoned a Leeds PhD student for 34 years in 2022 for simply retweeting some feminist activist tweets, and for Formula One, which has obviously been at the center of controversy recently with Christian Horner. I was wondering whether you've come up across any examples of particularly good International Women's Day corporate, like, sponsorship, or whether you think that it should be divorced from any kind of business incentive at all.
I don't think I've ever seen anything that's, like, worth remembering. Not in, like, a bad way, but I've not really seen anything from a business standpoint that's made me feel like, yeah, no, that includes me as well. But I think a part of me thinks it should be, like, devoid from this, like, commercial standpoint And again, like, not to be like, I grew up like this, but like for me and my family, it was like Mother's Day was more so like a wholesome day of like making your mum some toast. And I think that experience has really changed. But I think in order for it to be a powerful day, maybe it's best for it to be devoid from like the commercial and like monetary aspects of it.
Yeah, I saw one particularly awful example where McDonald's had inverted its golden arches to represent a W in 2018. And I think, especially as we've talked about how some of the issues surrounding International Women's Day in particular are like really extremely serious human rights issues, you wouldn't see companies getting involved with that kind of area of things in any other context, especially not in such a blatant marketing capacity. I think that's interesting. Maybe we need to get rid of International Women's Day as a corporate event, but keep it as more of an international geopolitical focus.
Yeah, and just kind of on that note, I feel like the commercialization of it and its place in business and as like International Women's Day as a money-making enterprise is so problematic. And also it brings up so many issues of just tying women again to like labor. And if we're trying to kind of problematize those borders between like having women's work actually be recognized in the marketplace and women actually being paid equally, which is not really realized anywhere fully. And then we just continue to bring it into the corporate sector and saying, oh, well, like we recognize women, they're girl bosses, they're empowered, but those steps aren't being taken. It's just such a hypocritical thing that both strips like the social meaning, like you were saying, from Mother's Day and like having that sentimental connection, but also really just kind of plasters over any actual change that could occur like in the business sector.
Yeah, I think especially like COVID was a bit of a step back for lots of women in terms of like losing their jobs and not being able to get back into work. And I think, yeah, there sometimes is a tendency to maybe think that we're already there, especially in the UK. But according to the 2023 Global Gender Gap Report, if we continue at the same pace that we currently are, it's going to take 131 years to reach gender equality. I think maybe we almost need to rebrand International Women's Day with a new urgency, because a lot of people, I think, see it more as a celebration of how far we've come in this country and maybe not so much as a driver for further change. So given how we've spoken about the official emphasis of this year's International Women's Day, Inspire Inclusion, which focused on technology and its ability to both expand and limit female expression, I think that, Nora, your story is particularly hard-hitting and really makes the case for continuing to celebrate International Women's Day. So could you tell us a bit about what you've been looking at this week?
Yeah, so this week I came across the story of these two sisters living in Afghanistan who are resisting the Taliban through song. After the return of the Taliban to power in Afghanistan in August of 2021, women saw essentially all of their rights curtailed. More broadly, everyday life was changed, but women and girls face the biggest impact. Girls beyond grade 6 are banned from education. Women are banned from working in local and international NGOs and government offices, with many international women who are working in Afghanistan for humanitarian reasons leaving their work. Women cannot travel without a male guardian, which effectively limits them from working in general, except for jobs that men cannot do, such as cleaning women's bathrooms. Female beauty salons, which previously were places of cultural sharing and spaces for women, were shut. Music and TV shows were pulled. And the burqa or niqab, which is Islamic modesty covering, which covers the face, and essentially only reveals their eyes, is mandatory. The important part of this is that the choice women are given to dress modestly or follow their religion is deprived, and they are forced to wear this. Many women are arrested for disobeying this ordinance and are only released after their male guardian has signed a decree stating that the woman would then observe it properly. These are matters of expression that only begin to scratch the surface of the oppression of the Taliban's rule, not to mention the humanitarian crisis of lacking physical, medical, and social resources. So in the face of all this, it would seem that there's little avenue of resistance for women. But two sisters in Afghanistan have demonstrated how even under the most oppressive of regimes, resistance and hope is possible. When the Taliban came back to power, two sisters whose names are changed in reporting for the sake of their safety started the movement called The Last Torch. The Last Torch is a singing movement on social media in which the sisters would upload videos of themselves fully covered in blue burqa to protect their identities singing. They said, "We're going to sing this, but it would cost our lives." They said that they take the name from the idea that, quote, women were the last hope that we could see. With the Taliban banning music, these sisters protest in the form of song and poetry, and with powerful words against their oppression is a clear, visible impact of their noncompliance. When we think about resistance, it often comes in the form of direct violence, but poetry and music have provided the space for grief and struggle to be met. It's interesting to see how women can take this space and utilize their grief and anger, but also hope to forge the resistance.
Yeah, thank you so much for introducing this story, because I think it's obviously extremely important and extremely emotive. And I think it's unbelievable, really, how little coverage Afghanistan has had, especially in UK media. I think partly related to sort of humiliation and maybe fatigue of Western powers who were obviously involved in the area for 20 years before that ended in defeat and withdrawal. I think what's particularly disturbing is that the UN has referred to this regime as gender apartheid, and yet this hasn't mobilized any real call to action for its members. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the International Commission of Jurists have all taken the position that the Taliban have committed crimes against humanity. And again, there hasn't really been any tangible input from Western sources. So I think it's really important to talk about, and I suppose in a way provides hope that some forms of opposition to the Taliban are being able to continue.
No, I think this is a really important topic and also something quite close to my heart, because I've spent the last 4 years like predominantly focusing on Middle Eastern studies, A, because I was brought up Muslim, and B, because I'm like, I am an ethnic minority and I would like to uncover a lot of colonial history to understand it better. But I specifically love focusing on the power of discourse and how we can use it to resist. I think we sometimes forget how powerful our own voices can be, and I think this is just a prime example of it. But it's such a unique experience of being a woman, and maybe something that we don't all understand. But I was very lucky that I wore a hijab from ages 11 to 16, and that was completely my own choice. And one day I decided I didn't want to do it, so I took it off. And that's something that maybe I took for granted a little bit, that freedom that I had. So I hope this isn't a complete reflection of like, this is what it means to be Muslim, because I was brought up Muslim and there's a lot of good in the religion. But this is like the reflections of men that think they know better and men that think they can rule. So it's not just also within the religion. It's like a much deeper issue that needs to be focused on a little bit more.
Yeah, one of the aspects I particularly loved about this story was that these two extremely brave girls, they're basically recapturing the burqa and the empowerment that sort of decisions around the burqa can have for women, because they're using it to mask their identity and enable them to, you know, speak out or sing out in this case against the Taliban. I think I did read that the girls have now actually fled Afghanistan because they were so concerned for their safety. And obviously, even though their identities are covered, there was the concern that people might overhear them. And they are both young schoolgirls, I think. But I think it is testament to the power of poetry and words in a world that increasingly doesn't value art forms, especially in the West. We've seen so many cuts to arts and culture, and, you know, things shouldn't just be valued in terms of the economic benefits that they bring to the country. And I think it's amazing to see how much of an impact internationally the actions of these girls have had.
Yeah, to kind of combine both of your points, I think art and poetry have a very specific place in, like you were saying, with discourse. It's very important. The impact of voice and speech as like a political form is something that is so incredibly powerful. Hannah Arendt, in her Origins of Totalitarianism, talks about the right to have rights. And she underlines this with the ability to speak and to act, and how speech is action. So these girls really taking their own words and taking their own voice is giving them that speech and that action and that beingness of being a human that they've been so deprived of by this oppressive regime. And like you were saying, when it comes to looking at the Taliban, you have to think about the autonomy of these women. It's not about that. This is not an Islamic issue. This is an issue of an oppressive regime that has decided to deprive women of their ability to express themselves. And art and expression is not like a luxury in everyday life. It's a necessity of being a human and being able to function in society and live a good and well life. So I think to both those points, it's just so deeply important. And acknowledging these women, especially when we're coming from a place in the West where there is a media fatigue and also a governmental fatigue to address this issue, these women are doing the work that no one else is trying to do or no one from the higher powers is seeking to do at this point.
Yeah, and I think it points to a really interesting issue that Bronwyn Maddox, who's the head of Chatham House think tank, was talking about recently, about just the hypocrisy of Western powers and their selective application of human rights. I mean, Afghan women are quite literally having to put their lives on the line. They're facing constant surveillance, harassment, assault, the threat of arbitrary detention, and conditions are just awful. It's the worst crisis for women internationally, according to numerous sources. And yet, countries continue to engage in business deals with Taliban leaders. Taliban leaders continue to fly freely on private jets and have sort of red carpets rolled out for them. And I just think it's really disturbing that issues like this almost seem to be brushed under the carpet almost. I think it's really important that all of us, I think, came across this story through a BBC documentary and report, which was really emotive and really well researched. But I just think that it's really concerning that we can rally behind support for Ukraine and almost feel as though we're doing our bit for international democracy by putting up Ukrainian flags or even Ukrainian refugees, but actually crises go so much further than that. And actually, it should be everyone's individual responsibility to look past what's reported in the media to maybe wider issues that governments don't necessarily want us to be engaging with because it doesn't coincide with their economic values and schemes.
Yeah. Just to add on to that, I think sometimes we all fall into the trap of thinking that we're in a post-colonial, decolonial era, but that's so far from the truth. And I think, truthfully, some lives are weighed more than others. Like, they have more value. Like, whether Western states are willing to admit that or not, they make it very clear with their actions. Like, this is just two out of millions of women who experience these things every day. But why don't we hear about it? And that is because some people's voices are heard much, like, louder than others. Like, it doesn't matter how loud you're shouting. If nobody's listening, there's not much that can be done. And, like, as people who all have privilege in different ways and are women and do resonate with these things, I think it is also our job to shout about it as well. Like, if the world's not listening, then together we should all shout about it and make sure that people don't forget and make sure that, like, we place value on people's lives.
Yeah, and particularly when we've been offered this amazing tool of the internet and technology that obviously these girls are using to its full potential, we do now have the ability to engage with issues even if they're not reported. And we do have the ability to transcend limitations that might be placed on us. So our final story takes today's theme in a slightly different direction, but I want to raise the bankruptcy of Birmingham City Council, which was initially announced in September and continues to dominate the headlines. This might be a story about government bureaucracy, but I also think it raises some important questions about the victims of organisational mismanagement, who, even in this country, tend to be women, children and marginalised social groups. So Birmingham is the UK's second largest city, and it has the second largest single-tier council in Europe. Its bankruptcy has therefore got particular significance, but it's actually just one of eight local authorities in England to have issued a Section 140 notice in recent years, which effectively declares an inability to balance the books. The alleged reasons for Birmingham Council's bankruptcy raised some questions around the state of women's rights in the UK. So when the council originally raised the Section 114 notice, it cited the overwhelming cost of equal pay claims, which amounted to around £700 million. These equality issues first came to light in the 2000s, and since then, a significant number of equal pay claims have been brought against the council, including one involving 4,000 female council workers across 49 different jobs, who argued that they'd been excluded from bonuses paid to those in traditionally male-dominated roles like refuse collectors and road workers. In itself, this is concerning, but what's even worse for me is that this was not actually the primary reason for the council's bankruptcy. So their financial issues had much more to do with the implementation of an Oracle IT system, which went live in April 2022 and led to at least 70,000 transaction errors and an inability to monitor budgets effectively. However, claiming bankruptcy on this basis would have made their financial position even more tenuous because their economic situation couldn't have been forecast reliably. Masking this issue redirected blame to the city's trade unions and elected Labour Party leadership under John Cotton, when in fact it had more to do with the council's senior executive team. Another angle I'd like to discuss is the implications of this bankruptcy, which typify the austerity cuts we've seen since 2010, namely the total defunding of the arts, cuts worth tens of millions of pounds to child and adult social care and housing, and the closure of 25 of the city's 36 libraries. These changes will have significant knock-on costs further down the line, and sadly, women and children are likely to be disproportionately affected. In outer city areas, where over half of children live in poverty and occupy substandard accommodation, cuts to youth centres threaten to deprive vulnerable young people of a safe space. Perhaps even more concerningly, a recent report suggested that Barossa services, which provide culturally sensitive support to South Asian women experiencing domestic abuse, are set to be reviewed, alongside the respite room service for domestic abuse survivors. These changes could be catastrophic, as women are statistically more likely to reach out to non-police services. The closure of a local library will also provide fewer places for domestic abuse victims to seek help, as they often provide a safe place for women and children. Equally, cuts to public transport and the dimming of streetlights will further endanger women at night. So all this suggests a rather bleak outlook, but I guess I'd like to start by asking you guys whether you think that local government services have a future in this country, or whether it would be more constructive to centralise our resources.
I think looking at funding governmentally between the local and the central and the impacts that that's going to have on the community is interesting, because you have to think about what's going to end up being priority. I feel like when we look at the money in a local sense, and I am thinking very much from a American perspective, which is town-based and then like city-based, counties, and then goes to the state and federal governments, it can kind of get really caught up in priorities and then also like the red tape of it. So when we're looking more at the central government and what that can provide, if we want to look towards actually ensuring that women and children have these spaces like libraries and youth centers and art centers, which will enrich their lives. And I don't think they should necessarily be seen as added bonuses, but necessities. It becomes difficult because it's basically about who's going to ensure that more. And when it comes to the central government and funding bare line things, there's just not a cultural priority for that. But clearly also when like local councils come into major financial issues, those are the first things to go. It's not going to be their priority either. So I think there kind of has to be a cultural shift around understanding. And this gets back to our issues of looking at where women's place is in the UK and more broadly. I think there has to be kind of an understanding of what is needed to actually support communities before we can kind of look at where the money is better going to emerge from.
Yeah, no, I think you raise a really important point there, that if the government in this country is serious about leveling up, as they like to brand it, then it really needs to be enacted at a local level, because the UK is becoming more diverse, but the diversity like concentration is also changing and moving to new areas. So it's actually like it involves a really intricate knowledge of what local communities need and want that can't really be extrapolated nationally. I think maybe one thing that is, I guess, encouraging and depressing at the same time is that I think the reason for Birmingham's bankruptcy is sort of emblematic of the wider failures of local governments, where just a lack of transparency, mismanagement, lack of risk management, and lack of commercial skills were actually more influential than, you know, maybe the more political issues surrounding local government implementation. So I don't think it's necessarily a lost cause is what I'm trying to say. And I know that a lot of the big consultancies have been doing sort of in-depth analytical reports on the future of local government. I think there's definitely a feeling that as we move into a general election and a likely Labour government, it might be the opportunity to sort of enact greater governance at a local level, and in the process, reshift these priorities back towards things like the arts that can be so transformative to communities, even if they're not maybe nationally felt in their influence.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I think right now we're seeing a system that just isn't working, and there needs to be like a major shift in priorities. And again, like linking back to the way that I grew up in a working class town, and I never really felt like our council represented what we needed. Like, I don't have much experience with arts and cultures growing up. Like, we had one small library and like a couple of pieces of art. And I wish I would have had the experience of being able to see those things and have those facilities, but I didn't. I had to like do it off my own back. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that should be an experience for any working class person to feel like you are not good enough to have any experience with arts and cultures. Like, I shouldn't have to come home at the end of a school day and try and like learn what this Latin words mean, what Latin words mean. But like, I did, I had to do that, whereas other people had an education that would allow them to learn that in their everyday life. I think there just needs to be like a massive shift in priorities that values arts and cultures, because it feeds into a massive habitus, and then like people aren't valued or people are seen as like being stupid when that's not the case. Like, you should be able to have equal opportunity, but also like an equality of outcome. Like, we should all be able to have access to those things. And I think it's something that's often forgotten.
Yeah. And I think it's such a shame, because Birmingham had been such a sort of pantheon of what could be possible for a local government authority. It is very large and obviously has proportionately greater resources, but things like the Maypole Youth Centre, I know, has had a massive impact locally. The Birmingham Rec Theatre, which has just had over £1 million of funding cut to zero, was a sort of symbol of local pride. And I think it's such a shame that these things have been allowed to get tangled up in a bureaucratic and unorganised system, which actually could have brought real benefits to the community. I think it's also important to say that I think it's easy to immediately assume that local government is always ineffective. I think that's the narrative that's almost pushed by central government, because it kind of feeds into the idea that we should be looking to central rather than localized structures. But actually, if we think back to COVID, and obviously it will have varied from local authority to local authority, but in terms of keeping frontline services open, like waste collection, opening up vaccine centres and mobilising those locally, that involved the coordination of like local authorities and was really quite successful. So I think it's easy to, you know, fall into the trap maybe of giving up on local government authorities when actually they can be used in quite a constructive way and have been in the past.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely something really important to be said about like the power of local authorities and councils and government in allowing these spaces in which we can actually make effective change happen. I think especially in the case of Birmingham, there needs to be more oversight potentially, but the central government, definitely their immediate priority is not going to be investing in culture and arts as a means of improving the country more broadly. I think there's always the focus when we look on the national level of the economic, quote unquote, jobs, quote unquote. But when it comes to, as we were discussing earlier, arts and culture, that is so important for social mobility, not only in the sense of you know, opening new avenues. But if there's not a place for kids who don't have a computer at home to go to a library and access a computer where they can either complete their homework or explore new schooling options for when they want to go to university or otherwise, they're just going to be, you know, brought away from these opportunities to kind of really improve. And the focus has never really been on arts and culture and how that can be a place where people can see these economic strides or these improvements to their life or their local community. And I think that emphasizing the local government has the potential to do that and fulfill that.
Yeah, and I think quite often central government obviously has been conservative for over a decade. And I think the tendency is to not really look at the broader picture and rather to get into the nitty-gritty politics of it. Often these councils are run by Labour councillors because the very nature of councils tends to be a more Labour agenda. And I think that because of this, government hasn't necessarily done all that it can to support these councils. Effectively, the way that councils are funded at the moment is through quite sporadic use of just different funding pots, which don't enable governments to make strategic long-term investments because they don't understand how they're going to be financed in the future. And if they did have a clear understanding of this, it would empower local authorities to address more systemic problems and maybe become a little bit more ambitious and more kind of sustainable in what they're able to provide. Because I think at the moment it's all very well kind of saying that they want to support the arts, but if they're not able to translate that into something that's economically saleable, then, you know, you can see why government's then able to say that the arts is not contributing to the wider commercial and economic success of the country. So I think, yeah, maybe the future of local authorities should be a less political future. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think sometimes there's too much of a focus on political point scoring when, like, I feel like governments, councils, like political entities in general kind of forget that, like, life is not a game. Like, we are all human. We should all be treated in a pretty similar way. But there's just this massive focus on, like, well, what party can do it better? Like, who's worse? Who's done something better? And I think that's very silly. So I hope in the future, like, we see a government that can work together more successfully to bring about, like, a better quality of life for everybody rather than focusing on treating life like it's a competition or something that, like, can be used to win points.
Yeah, and especially in the case of Birmingham City Council, the fact that the chief executives have essentially masked this whole issue of the Oracle IT system and laid all the blame at the door of the Labour councillor, which, you know, I'm not absolving John Cotton of all of the blame. Arguably, the decision to hold the Commonwealth Games wasn't the most economically savvy. But I do think that, yeah, there's definitely a tendency to over-politicise these systems that ultimately should be serving the very real and immediate needs of local populations and are really important to what our government is supposedly committed to, levelling up. So, yeah, he's hoping that maybe the re-election will see a shift in these dynamics. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Discourse. I hope we made you think, but I'd like to remind you that all views expressed in this episode were those of individual speakers and do not reflect the opinions of the saint. I'd like to end this episode on a well-known saying from Indigenous women activists in Australia, which really resonated with me in light of the issues we touched on this week. The saying goes, "If you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. If you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us walk together." Discourse was directed and hosted by me, Rosie Miller, and produced and edited by Natalie Olofsson. Our guests this week were Shakila Bessel and Noor Mahmoud.